Birmingham City Center is booming.
I was really blown away by what I saw in Birmingham. I've talked about it repeatedly in other cities in the United States and Europe.
But that investment is uneven.
While that is happening downtown, people in communities that's been neglected for 20 and 30 years, they're not getting any piece of the pie. They're not even getting the crumbs.
This is On the Line, Birmingham's Revitalization. I'm Andrew Yeager. This hour, we'll talk about who's benefiting and who's being left behind as Birmingham changes.
What you have to understand is that with 50 years of out-migration, 50 years of neglect, you can't turn that ship around overnight.
I hope you'll join in, too, with your comments and questions. That's On the Line, Birmingham's Revitalization. But first, this news from NPR. This is On the Line on your NPR news station, 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. I'm Andrew Yeager. Walk around Birmingham City Center and there's an energy you wouldn't have felt a few years ago. Residents are moving to new lofts and apartments. Restaurants and retailers are opening. People doing yoga at Railroad Park or taking in a ball game at Regents Field. They're visible signs of a Birmingham revival, but that revival is uneven. Talk to some in neighborhoods away from downtown, and they'll say revival doesn't mean much to them. No fancy lofts here, just abandoned homes and potholed roads that never seem to be fixed. And all this takes place against the backdrop of Birmingham's racial history. We'll talk about it this hour, and we hope that you'll join the conversation, too. Helping in the effort is we're joined this morning by Birmingham City Councilman Stephen Hoyt. He's in his third term on the council, represented in District 8, which covers part of the west side of the city. Also, Brian Wolf, Director of Development for Corporate Realty. He's been involved with a number of notable projects, including the Cityville Block 121 mixed-use development, Regents Field, and also the venue at the ballpark. And finally, Scott Douglas. He's Executive Director of Greater Birmingham Ministries. It's a multi-faith social service and advocacy organization working with low-income residents. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Well, we hope to hear from you this hour. We'll be taking your calls a little later on. You can also send us a message through the station Facebook page or on Twitter. And you can also join in a Twitter conversation going on right now. Just use the hashtag WBHMOTL. And Councilman Hoyt, I want to start with you because this revival in Birmingham attracts headlines, gets glossy spreads in magazines. When you talk to folks around the country as you travel, what do you tell them's happened in Birmingham the last 5 to 7 years?
Well, I think for all practical purposes, Birmingham is experiencing a renaissance, a rebirth of something that was once great is coming back to life again. I think that there is a need for balance in terms of how we grow as a city. I think it's important that we grow on all sides, that we just don't put all of our efforts in downtown. But we have to strike a balance with the outlying areas. And, of course, I think we're making some attempt to do that even as we speak, quite frankly.
We'll talk more about some of those attempts. But, Brian Wolf, from your perspective, these last 5 to 7 years for a developer, for an investor, what's the climate been like?
The climate's actually been very good, Andrew. The fundamentals of Birmingham have been one of there is a demand there. We've got a generation of folks who have put off buying houses for a period of time, which has driven demand on the multifamily side. We also have, an aging population that's retiring. A lot of younger folks are moving in to fill those positions, and they want to be a part of that renaissance, as Councillor Hoyt said.
And Scott Douglas, you're sitting in a little bit of a different vantage point, but when you look at the development, what are the thoughts that come to your mind?
We've heard for a long time that the wonderful investments in downtown Birmingham will increase the tax revenue sufficiently so off that revenue the city can make other investments in the other communities. It's a wait and see, and we're still waiting.
You're still waiting. What would be evidence of that?
Two things. Evidence would be some visible sign of some real anchoring-type developments in the outlying neighborhoods, not just houses, but the stores and the schools. One of the big things we missed when we built a lot of schools with this bond issue, tax issue years ago, nobody thought about tying housing development in the low-income neighborhoods to those beautiful new schools. So, which could have been an anchor for attracting teachers, others, mixing the income of the neighborhood much more. What we lack is incapacity to develop synergy when we spend our monies.
So synergy, anchor institutions, those are the sorts of things that yes. you're looking for. So, Councilman Hoyt, you referred to this when I asked mm-hmm. you this a moment ago. How do you deal with that tension? Because when you're in public service, you're dealing with a lot of demands, and sometimes they're in conflict. Right. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think Scott is right on one hand, but I do believe that there are some inklings of a revitalization that's taking place when you talk about gentrification with respect to, Park Place downtown. It's a mixed development done by the Housing Authority and by private developers. When you look at Tuxedo Terrace, you look at what primarily and even the Woodlawn area has been attributed to public funds and private funds because the city did participate in that to some degree. But we have to have more. And I think what we're proposing to do at the Crossplex, developing the outer lines of the Crossplex, certainly would speak to that. Thrust has been, as a council who represents that western part of town, is to develop it, and so that we too could experience the Renaissance that's taking place downtown. And I think there are a lot of things that are forthcoming, but they have not yet been realized, as Scott has indicated. But they're happening more than not, and I think Region Field. Railroad Park was a great impetus to that, the whole synergy of downtown being redeveloped. And, and I've been here on the council for 11 years, so I've helped to help shape that as both having chaired budget and finance and economic development for the city, and now public safety and transportation. Because I think we're going to have to tie in transportation to some of this, of what we're dealing with in terms of having a real quality of life and to be able to get people to and fro.
Brian Wolf, I saw you shaking your head there, and obviously you're in the private sector. And you talked about some of those larger market forces as driving this renaissance, people returning to city centers, that pent-up demand from the recession, people buying homes. But when you look to the public sector, when you look to the city of Birmingham, what is it that needs to happen for developments like the ones you've been involved with to be successful?
Well, a couple of things. Councilor Hoyt and his colleagues and the mayor saw a vision for what Railroad Park could do for the city. And then in making that investment and making the investment that they did in Regents Field, has really created an environment where, as a real estate investor, we have felt confident that they have produced not only those two pieces of what we call urban infrastructure in downtown Birmingham, but also making sure that we've got correct zoning overlays and we've got money budgeted in the capital budget for hardscape landscape improvements in that area. They created an environment down there for an investor to come in and have confidence that when they invest in that area, it's gonna stay maintained, and it's gonna be a great place for people to live, to work, and really to be part of that renaissance, as Councilor Hoyt put it.
So the infrastructure's got to be in place, and the red tape's got to be taken care of.
Correct.
You're listening to On the Line on your NPR news station, 90.3 WBHM. 91.5 WSGM. That was Brian Wolf, Director of Development with Corporate Realty. We're also talking with Birmingham Councilman Stephen Hoyt and Greater Birmingham Ministries Executive Director Scott Douglas. We hope that you'll join us this hour as well. Call 1-800-444-9246. That's 800-444-9246. And you can offer your question or comment. Also, Facebook, Twitter, and our Twitter hashtag is WBHMOTL. And Scott Douglas, we're talking about this development in the city center. We're talking about the infrastructure that you get from the public sector. But for you, as you look at this, sort of Where do the neighborhoods fit into this, particularly neighborhoods that aren't part of that city center?
That's a good question. In my experience, while we have a wonderful participation from through our 99 neighborhoods and our 35 communities, I have yet to see a platform, a table, so those neighborhoods can effectively be at the table when development decisions are made. I do have one experience, and Councilor Hoyt may know different from me. I know of one experience back in the 90s where a bottoms-up neighborhood movement created a $10 million bond issue. For the first time, a bond issue ever came from the citizens themselves. And we asked Mayor Arrington, what do we need to get it passed? He said, you need 5 votes.
Meaning the 5 votes on the Birmingham City Council.
And so we went from neighborhood to neighborhood, and they got with all their city council people. And there were several bond issues that year, and the housing bond issue came out number one. Number one. Because the neighborhoods were invested from the very beginning, and they knew this was for infrastructure. Habitat, Beat, and other areas were building low affordable housing in depressed neighborhoods, but the city didn't have the money for the sidewalks and the lights, the infrastructure around that. And that's what that bond issue was for. And even though every neighborhood would not get the benefit of that, they knew it, they had a fighting chance to apply for it, those other nonprofits.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, and Scott, I didn't know how that happened, but I do know that this council voted a $150 million bond issue. Mm-hmm. We've already spent $75 million of those dollars, and we're proposing to spend the second half of that money for neighborhoods and to provide infrastructure and public facilities in terms of bringing them back to some reasonable state. And again, you know, and I guess we don't publicize it enough, really, in terms of what we're doing. And I think last year we experienced about $6.2 million with respect to neighborhood revitalization, taking care of the blightness that exists in these outlying areas, as well as overgrown lots and those things. Just recently we announced a program citywide to bring LED lighting, LED lighting, mm-hmm. That's right.
Right.
To the neighbors and throughout the city. And I think, Scott, if you've been following the politics, that's been one of my pet peeves, is that our city's too dark.
Yeah.
And it breeds crime when things are so dark. And I like to be able to see see what color the car is, what color the person had on, you know, but it makes for a safer city, and we're doing that. And you have to thank the mayor and the council both for believing in what I've been trying to say is an issue, because if you light it up, then the criminals have a way of disappearing to some degree. Now, that doesn't mean they never stop breaking in during the day, but they may stop breaking in at night.
Well, Councilman Hoyt, with this idea of neighborhoods, mm-hmm. city developers, when you do have a project that comes up, mm-hmm. how do you talk with neighborhoods about it? I mean, thinking about Regent's Field, granted mm-hmm. it's not in a neighborhood, but you had property owners who were there already that may have different interests. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that discussion when there's sort of this greater good of a ballpark, right. but
well,
their business?
Yeah, but one of the things we did was to take the council around the various neighborhoods, and so that we can't talk to every resident, but we were there in each of those districts and each of those communities just trying to say what it is that we were doing. We have even hired a public information person to kind of do the messaging of the council and the city as we move towards revitalizing. And, of course, even this budget will reflect neighborhoods like you've never seen before. So, and quite frankly, the CAB, which is a conglomerate of all the neighborhoods, the 99 neighborhood, meets on a monthly basis. And occasionally they would invite the council to go in and to talk about things that they're doing. But each individual council, as I do, attend every neighborhood meeting in my district. And so on a monthly basis, and so we, you know, we're attuned to some of the ills that that beset the neighborhood. And so that's the only way I know to do it. And now we got a program called an Everbridge program, which is a telephone program where we can put our message out, and it has the capabilities of calling in homes in this entire county. And so, and we can zero it down to a specific neighborhood. And so that's really helping us. And it, and Scott, I might need to brag, but it came under my administration as chair of public safety, because this was something that we needed. And it was a direct result of what happened with the tornado of
2011.
April, 2011, mm-hmm. Right. That we can inform not only with the siren, if the siren doesn't work, then we can send out this telephone message to all of our residents, and even have a program called 911 texts. That was something that my wife brought to my attention. She said, "What happens, you know, if you're in a situation and you can't talk, but if you could just text 911?" And so we have that capability as well. So there are a lot of good things that are happening. And certainly is a service to all the citizens.
So neighborhood communication, revitalization, those are all under discussion this hour here on WBHM. We'll take a quick break. In the meantime, if you'd like to join the conversation, call 800-444-9246, 800-444-9246. I'm Andrew Yeager. Stay with us.
The revitalization has been a great success. New businesses, any way that we can attract new businesses to come in and stay is a great thing. And, you know, maybe add more money for the library and for the schools.
That's Jonathan Newman, who happens to be a librarian here in Birmingham, talking about his hopes for a rebounding city. What do you think as Birmingham revitalizes, the unevenness of it? I'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-444-9246, or go on to our Facebook page, or join the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag WBHMOTL. I'm Andrew Yeager. Here with us this morning, Birmingham City Councilman Stephen Hoyt, also Greater Birmingham Ministries Executive Director Scott Douglas, and the Director of Development for Corporate Realty, Brian Wolf. And also joining the conversation right now is Arnold. Arnold's calling from Birmingham. And Arnold, what do you have to say?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm thankful for the opportunity to share some of the things, some of the dialogue we've been having in our neighborhood. I'm a neighbor of Councilman Hoyt, and we're very proud of the work that he's doing and the structure that's being shared to help us push our vision for our neighborhoods forward. At the baseline of all these conversations is of development has to be how homeowners are going to speak up and project what they want to see in their neighborhoods, whether that is policing, whether that is trash collection, whether that is the crime that's running rampant in many of the neighborhoods.
Right.
Many times the administration of the city, police departments don't take us seriously because we don't take ourselves seriously. We have to begin a dialogue, an honest one, amongst ourselves as neighbors, connecting one with the other to create a net to let people know we're not going to have this crime that you're trying to bring into our neighborhood, whether it's coming from the outside or whether it's coming from the inside of the neighborhood. We need to band together and get together to project what our thoughts are, what our desires are for our neighborhood, then partner with the police department, with the administrations, once we come up with a collective voice to see the change we want to see in our community.
Yeah. Arnold, let me ask this. Do you feel like you have an effective way of communicating what you want to see in your neighborhood, whether it's to city council members, people in the city, or the business community?
Well, the conversation for me begins with a small group of men in my neighborhood. We have a very active, effective councilman that comes to our meetings, that hears our concerns and sows seeds to those concerns. So that's a good start. And these things have to start that way because it's from the ground up instead of from the top down. We can't expect the mayor's office or the police department to do for us what we won't do for ourselves.
All right, Arnold.
We're not talking about young people where there's no snitching thing is really changing the game. We're not talking about that. We're talking about older folks.
Well,
45, 50, 60 years old that don't want to get involved. They think these things that are happening around them, where they own their properties and where their families lie their heads, they think these things don't have anything to do with them. And they do have a voice to speak on it.
And to Arnold's credit, would you share with them what you and a group of folk did with respect to the signage that you all have in your yards that really has helped to maintain some quality of life in Bellevue Heights?
Yes, sir. Last year, we saw a spike in robberies in our neighborhood, and people were kicking in doors at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning. Residents that had been in the neighborhood 30-plus years were getting robbed as they were cutting their grass. I'm like, wait a second. So a few of us got together, spent about $150 out of our pockets to put signs up, and the signs read, "Concerned Neighbors Watching in Bellevue Heights End." So, I mean, it was very simple, very straightforward. And what happened around those two dozen signs was a dialogue. It was incredible. People were coming and knocking on my door, ringing the phone, looking for signs. But as they were looking for signs, they were sharing stories of things that were happening down the street, around the corner, of things that we probably wouldn't have known because in many cases we don't connect with each other that way. But those signs opened up a dialogue beyond anything I could have imagined at the outset of it. So when we start sowing seeds in our community that way, when we start getting involved, knowing that we have a role to play, then we can be effective. And then we can meet with development. When we have developers that are coming into Five Points West, they can see, oh, we have an active neighborhood association over here. These people are taking care of business. They're trying to really show that they are on the ball with what they want to see, and they're not going to have a lot of this deterioration that we've been seeing in our neighborhood. Been in my home this year 18 years, and some of these things that I'm sharing this morning have been over the past 2 years.
All right, Arnold, thank you so much for your thoughts and comments there. Brian Wolf, we've been talking about this idea of communication. And for you as a developer, how do you negotiate that conversation between folks on the ground, whether they're residents or whether they're existing businesses or property owners, and what you want to do as an investor?
Yeah, absolutely. So the city has a very good neighborhood infrastructure in place in terms of the way their communities are organized. And so as a developer, when we go to pull permits or such, we're required to go meet with those neighborhoods. And frankly, we like to go meet with those neighborhoods even when we're not required. And so we want to make sure that they're buying into what we're about to go and present to the city and make sure they, if there's any comments they may have on our plans, we get those implemented to the greatest extent possible. And they feel like a stakeholder because they are a stakeholder in this community. And we're coming into a community in which they live, in which they work and play, and their kids are growing up, and we want to make sure that we're a good neighbor just like they are.
This is On the Line on your NPR news station, 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. You can join the conversation by calling 800-444-9246, 800-444-9246, or send us a comment on Facebook or with the Twitter hashtag WBHMOTL. And Scott Douglas with Greater Birmingham Ministries, as we're continuing this theme of communication, particularly with the city, with developers, with neighborhood residents. Do you feel like folks listen on the ground?
It depends.
Of course.
The greatest listening I've seen in my experience, I'm a former neighborhood officer from way back, is when the people in neighborhoods are given information to be equipped to engage in the conversation. I've seen some situations when developments come into areas and it's fully thought out, you know, before neighborhoods are included. But I've seen better examples when the neighborhoods were included initially some years ago from the bottom up. We participated in doing a neighborhood survey in what was Sandy Bottom out there in Inslee. It's now called Sandy Vista. Mm-hmm. And one of the people said, why do we need a survey? Because we already know what we want. I said, you need a survey so everybody can buy into it. You talk to everybody in the area. And then when the survey results come back, oh, I contributed that. So the idea is sometimes not finding out information as much as it is getting neighbor by neighbor individual buy-in. And that conversation has to be ongoing. That way when you meet with the city and developers and architects and others, the neighborhood's voice has not just been heard, they feel like it's been heard. And that's important.
Yeah, Ron Narrett, who was, I guess, the general of that whole movement, mm-hmm. Wrote a book called Reweaving the Fiber, yeah. That talked about Santa Vista and what it used to be and how you could just reach up and touch the, you know, the utility lines and those kind of things just from the ground. And it was a desolate place, but as he pastored there, saw the condition of the community and wanted to do something to change that. And I think it helps to, when you talk about communication, Ron was a trained journalist.
Yes.
And a former anchor person. And so he knew how to communicate that message with not only with the people in that community, but with corporate America, and got them to invest in the idea of revitalizing that area. And I guess that's one of the things that keeps me going now is because of Ron Narrett and his concern for people and all of God's people is trying to, you know, go in and make the assessment. And I always think that we always need consumers to be a part of the movement. Mm-hmm. Because who can best dictate the needs of the community than those who have been a part of that community? And so, but it is a good process. I don't think we really really celebrate Birmingham enough for its organization of its neighborhoods. Matter of fact, we're the best practices in the United States of America. I won number one neighborhood program in America with NUSA in 2011 for what I do in Inslee, the Day of Empowerment, which is Party with a Purpose. And out of that has grown Education with a Purpose. Just recently gave $10,000 to college-bound students. And this is our third year doing that. And this is our signature year because it's 10 years that we've been trying to make a difference in Inslee. And it all started because if you know, as you all well know, that every other day was a murder. And so I can tell you emphatically that since we've been having this the first weekend in October, there's not been a single murder the week of that or leading up to Party with a Purpose. And so it is making a difference in that community, but it's also a job fair, a day of empowerment, an educational fair. Create a CD for college-bound students so they can just put it in a CD and go to any school in America with this CD that we created for that. So those are the kinds of things I guess we're not celebrating. And in 2013, I won fourth place in the nation. They said they were going to give me first place twice, so I accepted that too. But nevertheless, it's his best practices throughout the world because people come to NUSA from all over the world. From Japan and from England and other places. So we have a good structure when it comes to neighborhood empowerment.
Yeah. Well, head back to the phones. Lindsay is with us. Lindsay, go ahead. Oh, I guess Lindsay is no longer with us. We do have a question, though. This is a question from Twitter. Scott asks, what initiatives can individuals help with? What can individuals do to continue spur the revitalization that they're seeing downtown or in their own communities? I don't know who wants to take that.
I'll take one to sound like my name. um, think Councilor Hort mentioned it, and the Arnold, the person who called in, is about it. What one individual can do is connect with another individual neighborhood. That's the most important connection. And they together connect with others to bring some ideas before their neighborhood association or their area merchant association. Too often, I've seen people get really frustrated. Good, decent people with great ideas try to carry the ball all by themselves. And they get turned down, they get rebuffed, and they either go the two A's, I call it. They go apathetic or they get angry. But it's
sometimes both.
I've never seen apathetic anger, but but I do think the first one thing to do is connect with another one. I've seen people who in their neighborhoods say, come to GBM and say, help us start a nonprofit or help us start a ministry. And I say, join one. Join one. Add your strength to theirs. We can't have, you know, one church, one member, one nonprofit, one member type of mentality going on. So the best thing one individual can do is find another one and begin to build off of that.
Right. You're listening to On the Line on your NPR news station, 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call or send us a message by Facebook or on Twitter. Hashtag is WBHM. OTL. I have a question here from Dan on Facebook, and is asking, how does revitalization in Birmingham impact area cities? I don't know who wants to take that. Perhaps Brian or Councilman Hoyt.
I think when you have a healthy city center, it can't help but to impact other municipalities in and around it, because then they have an opportunity to come to Birmingham to work, as I have experienced and know friends who've been working in Birmingham as long as I've been in Birmingham for 36 years, but they drive from Gaston and been gainfully employed with that understanding. And so, if Birmingham does well, then I think other municipalities within Jefferson County do well as well. And in this case, you're talking about two counties away. Gaston, you got to go through St. Clair County to get to Gaston. So it has made a tremendous impact. And when I visited Mercedes-Benz last year and discovered that people were driving from Gaston to go to Tuscaloosa to work every day, even as far away as Huntsville. It's prudent that cities like Birmingham continue to thrive, and that we continue to create opportunity within the city center. And certainly, I look at the airport as also being a drawing card for the city. I view the airport as the economic engine because we're trying to work on now some international flights to take place that you can fly directly to Birmingham from, any parts of Europe and what have you. But, we're still, very close. Hadn't gotten there yet, but working with the governor's office and City of Birmingham and other entities like BBA and others certainly helps us in that effort.
So I believe Lindsay is back with us. Lindsay, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go right ahead.
I work with chronically homeless individuals in the Birmingham area, work very closely with One Roof Program and HUD, and we've had some difficulty. While Park Place has been a wonderful project, it continues to be a food desert, as well as we have a great Jefferson County HUD office, but it is over an hour, a mile and a half off the nearest bus line, and it's been kind of that there's been these gaps in great ideas, but the fruition of them for our low income or folks coming up off the streets has been kind of lacking. I didn't know if there was plans to solve these two issues.
Well, the HUD office is located in the Medical Forum building, and so I don't know if you got to walk a mile, because the bus and I forget the other one that goes directly from north to south runs right in front of the Medical Forum, which is a Sheraton hotel. But I think the Jones Valley farm is located in Central City.
That's the one that's downtown, but the
right
one that services a lot of HUD is way out past Inslee. for that services Park Place. That's the Housing Authority for Park Place itself.
I guess I don't understand your question.
Well, nevertheless, I mean, I think the issue here is that, you know, you have all these amenities, you have these great mm-hmm. things going on downtown, but there are people that can't access this, and transportation, mm-hmm.
well, transportation is a big issue. Right.
Yeah, and so, and I guess, you know, Brian, from your perspective, that's not your responsibility as a developer, but it affects you as a developer.
It does. I mean, what we like to see when we come into a community, whether it's Birmingham or anywhere else in the Southeast, is that there's a plan in place. And I think, back to Scott's point, I think that each one of the neighborhoods, some neighborhoods do a better job than others in making sure that they have a groundswell of putting a plan together, presenting that to their councilman, and making sure that gets prioritized in the city's budget so that we're, you know, creating actionable plans in which those communities can start to resolve some of the issues in their communities. I mean, Councilman Hoyt mentioned the lighting issue, which is a big issue across our city, but having a grassroots campaign to build a plan of here are our priorities for the next year, and making sure that gets into the budgeting process that Councilor Hoyt's going through right now at City Hall, and making sure that there's money set aside to attack those issues and help those communities come back and promote development. We just like to see that there's a plan in place so that we have confidence in investing in those places.
We'll continue the conversation here on WBHM and WSGN. Want to hear from you? 800-444-9246 or go to Facebook or Twitter. Be back in just a moment.
You can look at it in a positive way and a negative way. A positive way is that you will break up concentrations of poverty. The negative would be where it breaks up and, you know, leaves people sometimes homeless, displaced, and, you know, that's what we don't want.
That's Maisha Hutchinson, president of the Oak Ridge Park Neighborhood Association, talking about the potential results of Birmingham's growth. In her case, it's in the Woodlawn community. And we are talking about Birmingham's revival this hour with Birmingham City Councilman Stephen Hoyt, Director of Development for Corporate Realty Brian Wolf, and Greater Birmingham Ministries Executive Director Scott Douglas. And joining the conversation right now is Doug in Vestavia Hills. Doug, go ahead.
Yes. A question about the development of, or the prospects for development of single family homes. There's been quite a bit of development along Highland Avenue. There's some $1 million homes being built there now, and there are a lot of condo developments along Highland Avenue. But my question is concerned mainly with single family homes closer to the city center. And say, for instance, in the area of Railroad Park, and I'll just take my answer off the air.
Okay, great. Thanks, Doug. And Brian, what is the prospect for development like that?
Well, condo used to be a dirty word in our business in the last 5 years, both from the lending perspective and also just in our city in general. But I think what we're starting to see, and I think Scott mentioned this off the air during our break, was that we're starting to get a lot of phone calls from empty nesters that are looking to come back down and be a part of this renaissance, that may not necessarily want to rent an apartment, that want to own something in and around the Railroad Park. I think there is going to be an opportunity for some townhome development, for some condo development on a smaller scale, testing those waters and seeing how the market reacts. I know that the supply of downtown condominiums is very tight right now, just based on some conversations I've had with other residential realtors. But there is definitely an opportunity for somebody that's in that space to come in and begin to test those waters.
And so what do you do? Because condos, the apartments that are being built, they are high-end. And developers have specifically said, that's what we're building, and it makes sense. They're going to go after as much of a return as they can get. But that's not for everyone. So what do you do? Do you just wait for the marketplace to respond?
Well, I mean, the apartments that we have constructed over the last 3 years have definitely been on the higher end of the marketplace. But I do think there are some definite opportunities for the right developer to come in and build what I kind of term as more workforce-type housing, which is more affordable. We don't really have a problem quite yet of the city gentrifying to a point that we're forcing people out of neighborhoods. But I do think in order to get people into these neighborhoods and get them into housing that is more workforce-oriented and is more affordable is something that is definitely an opportunity for somebody over the next few years.
Well, Scott Douglas, as Brian said there, doesn't really believe we're at the point where people are getting forced out, and as we've seen these developments go up, they're mostly on unused or vacant properties. But as you think about the shifting changes in Birmingham, by and large, they're white folks that are moving into these neighborhoods that have, for the last generation, been black. Do you see those tensions being played out?
Yes, I've seen being played out. Deja vu again. A lot of these neighborhoods, especially in the eastern section, that say used to be black, used to be white first.
Sure. Woodlawn, for instance?
Yeah, Woodlawn, for instance, where the during the white flight period, folks moved out to form new suburbs, and African-Americans increasingly moved in. And there was something that happened. The city, this is even pre-Arrington times when it first started, is that that the city began to lose interest in those areas that were being depleted. Number one, today, it, with a few exceptions, economic segregation has replaced racial segregation in housing, but they look just the same. That's because poverty tracks race very strongly in Alabama. Yeah.
Well, there's a historic correlation between the two.
A historic correlation between the two. Kind of reinvesting in the inner cities at the scale of model cities and other initiatives from the 60s and 70s hasn't happened yet. I think the councilor would know that the monies for affordable housing programs in the city, in any city, has shrunk from Congress year after year after year after year. There were things we could do in 1985 we can't do now.
And one of those things that you have to consider, HUD is putting a lot of emphasis on public-private partnerships now. Before you had RAD, which is a rental assistance demonstration, we could not borrow against our assets. But now we're able to do that, and it brings in the private sector to say that, you know, we can do this together. And of course, you begin to see, I think you're going to begin to see some things now. HUD is primarily trying to get out of the public housing business. There's a lot of thrust behind mixed development, which I think speaks to both, the upper middle class to the low and moderate middle class families. But, you know, we got to call it what it is. It's called gentrification. But in that, there are pros and cons, because once we experience gentrification, what comes with it is, you know, higher property values, but also becomes safer communities. And so, you got to kind of balance all of that out. And I think, you know, having an aggressive affordable housing program for the city, I think helps to balance that, and that may be single-family detached homes, because I think you know, you have greater ownership when you have detached homes as opposed to multifamily or so. But multifamily is certainly a way to repopulate the city as it grows and what have you, but providing for affordable housing, because I think the balance is there. And a lot of times what happens with gentrification is the fact that you have historical preservations being implemented in various communities. And, you know, while we welcome that, but if I'm next door and I don't have the income that you have as a professional or a person, and you know, we get that designation, and you don't know that when you go and pull your permit, you got to restore your house back to the original state. Now, the struggle has been over the years is getting the state to match what the federal government does with historical tax credits. And so the state has done that, but now they're trying to sunset it. And I don't know if that's a good thing. I think it helps all of us.
I want to jump in here because Nina is with us, and Nina has some thoughts related to this idea about people being displaced. Nina? Are you there? Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, I just started listening to the program really late, so I'm not sure if this has been touched on. But one thing that I've heard a lot in discourse is gentrification and displacement. And I was wondering, are there any efforts to track the displacement of Birmingham residents in certain areas, you know, to have, I guess, hard numbers on the people who are being displaced? And also, there's an integration factor, I feel like, that it needs to be talked about more. A lot of events and a lot of places that are being revitalized are really, you know, to me, segregated. I feel like there's either all black events or all white events, and there's not a lot of mixing going on. I see it in bars. I see it in stores. I see it in farmers markets. I see it really everywhere. And I was wondering, how can that be addressed?
Okay. I'll take two of those things. First of all, the issue about is this being tracked? I don't know. Scott Douglas, if you...
I can speak to that.
Okay.
Well, as it relates to public housing resident, it has to be tracked. HUD is, you know, certainly want the deconcentration of poverty to take place, but not at the expense of poor folk or low to moderate income folk. And so part of that whole irony is to track that person, you know, maybe 3 to 4, 5 years to ensure that we are not creating another situation and what have you. But I can't speak for the private market, but for the public perception, it's certainly that's the task. And matter of fact, HUD requires that we replace unit for unit under the RAD demonstration. Unlike Hope 6, we only had to do a percentage of that.
That's what I thought.
Right.
Hope 6 displaced a lot of people.
Huh? Yeah. Well,
I mean, they went to Park Place.
Well, but from the housing authority standpoint, we still house them in our present housing stock. But, you know, sometimes it's about choice, you know, because at the end of the day, whether you're poor or rich, the common denominator is where my child go to school. And having worked with the homeless population for many years, Scott, that was the common. And it shocked me because it didn't matter how poor, how uneducated, whether they were black or white, they want to know what school is where you're going to get to place me, even though they were homeless. And I was trying to put them in temporary housing. They wanted to know what schools are in that area. Because they knew, felt a sense of them, you know, this was a way for their children to come up. They were concerned, even though they didn't have an education, they wanted their children to have one.
I want to get to that second point that Nita had, and the fact that it seems that through self-segregation, if you're out in public places, there are black places and white places. I mean, I think I was at Railroad Park last night. Railroad Park is, I would argue, one of the few public spaces that genuinely is pretty mixed, but if you go to other areas of the city, that's not really the case. And Brian Wolf, I mean, does that sort of divide play into your thinking at all as you think about development or projects?
No, certainly not. We're trying to create places where we're trying to attract everybody to come together. And I think, I mean, to your point on Railroad Park, I mean, it's great. I bring my family down there regularly. It's been a great somewhat melting pot for different districts of our city to come together. It's great to see it on an afternoon when, you know, Blue Cross and Blue Shield sponsors a great exercise a series down there. A lot of people come together, and that park is very well programmed. They do a great job with it. And I think creating places like that where our city can come together, where it's at Regents Field or Railroad Park, I think, I mean, just Regents Field is a great example of of something that's really gentrified. Yes. Our city and brought a lot of folks together that didn't used to come together, and it's great to see that. And I think we've got to make sure that we do that going forward.
And Scott Douglas, what do you think are the ingredients to see that happens, that you get a railroad park, you get someplace where everyone feels comfortable despite the history of this area?
Interesting. Participation of all sectors of the community at once. Unfortunately, I think it's true. We still have to work at, and speaking to the caller, we still have to work at convening across race,
and neighborhoods some thinking about how to make Birmingham better, how to make Birmingham more inclusive, how to make Birmingham more accepting, how to make Birmingham more positive towards its future. And I think a lot of the concerns is about this generation is more perceptive of racial divides than other generations that took it for granted. So it's not that we're getting worse. We're getting better. But the new generation wasn't there when it was worse.
Well,
and I do think it's important that they keep that kind of positive, critical eye towards how Birmingham grows closer together in a shared purpose.
Well, and I think we have to be intentional in terms of what we do with respect to race, respects to economic parity. You know, children are missing out on intellectual and cultural exchanges, as I see it, because the world doesn't operate on that principle. The world is very diverse. And if we're not promoting that, and I don't think we're doing enough of it, I'm going to respectfully disagree with my good friend Scott. I just don't see it. You know, our schools are more segregated than they ever been. I went to school from elementary school, from Head Start with white children in Gaston. Okay. And through my whole educational experience, it's been in a diverse environment. And we did well. The school did well. The children did well. And now we have children, the Birmingham school system have very few white children.
Right.
At all. And so we look at Princeton, we look at Ramsey, we look at W.J. Christian, and we're saying, wow, the Birmingham school system is doing well. I was in Leadership Birmingham. And so our takeaway that day was like, well, you know, Birmingham is doing well. I said, no, that's not what I see. What I see is that we're missing out, and because we don't have the exchange. And I said, when is a child from Mountain Brook going to come to Park and Park or go to Mountain Brook?
Well, and I want to jump in here.
Yes.
Because we're getting toward the end of the program. Okay. Many more conversations to have, many more differing views to explore. But I'd like to thank our guest this hour, Birmingham City Councilman Stephen Hoyt, Brian Wolf, the Director of Development for Corporate Realty, and also Greater Birmingham Ministries Executive Director Scott Douglas. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, today's program was produced by Rachel Lindley and myself, with help from Esther Chamakili, Andre Nada, Wes Henry, and Joseph Bodkin. Technical support from Daryl McCullough. Our general manager is Scott Hanley. I'm Andrew Yeager. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.